In Scotland, when friends get together, they blether. When these three friends happen to be Scottish Blue Badge tourist guides, you can be sure that the country that they're so passionate about will be right at the heart of their discussions. Be it contemporary or historical, culinary or cultural, reminiscence or anecdote, from accommodation to zoos, the chat will range right across the entire alphabet of topics and issues that are live and happening in Scotland right now. We hope that you'll join us. There's nothing to beat a richt good blether.
And you could also join in our blethers on social media. You can find us as at Scottish Blethers on both Facebook and Instagram. We post additional content during the week that supports the podcast episode.
We love making the podcast and would love it if you could share them with your friends and leave a review on the platform of your choice.
Good morning and welcome to Scottish Blethers. I'm Liz Lister.
And I'm Helen Houston. Good morning to you all.
Good morning. It's a cold and frosty morning here, Helen.
Oh, it certainly is. The temperature just plummeted and now we've had a few days of it. I must say I do like it like this though, because it's been dry and really cold.
Beautiful sunrises and sunsets. Yeah. The only thing is there's about an inch of frost on your windscreen.
Oh, it's so hard to scrape. I must say with the windscreen, I prefer to scrape it rather than put any of these sprays on it.
Yeah, but I'm afraid I'm guilty of using my credit card. I've wasted a few credit cards. Well,
actually,
do that anymore.
I'm doing a clear out of my office at the moment and looking through all the piles of stuff that should be cleared out. And I found three out-of-date credit cards. So I've got three that I'll put in the car for scraping.
Perfect. Well, it's a long, long thought to think of summer holidays in St Andrews, but last week we started on the theme of St Andrews because it was St Andrews Week, the patron saint of Scotland. It was his day on the 30th of November, our national holiday. And so it was too good an opportunity to miss an episode on the links of St Andrews with golf.
That's right. And I think you're still very much a golfer, Liz. I gave up golf when my son started playing golf with my golf clubs. And he didn't really realise that obstacles were not to be taken down with the golf club. The ball was to be moved. So a few trees managed to come in the way of his golfing and the heads of my clubs. So I haven't played since Alistair played.
Well, you're very kind in saying that I'm still a golfer, but I was never a golfer. In the words of Mark Twain, it was a good walk spoiled. And for about 4 years, I had a chronic bad back that I was absolutely disabled with. And then I gave up golf and my back recovered. So, you know, I'm not a golfer, but as we live in Salon, small village in West Fife, at the heart of Salon is the golf course.
Yes, and it's a very interesting golf course because it's basically on a hill. So you learn to do hill walking and hill climbing very quickly with your golf bag.
Yeah, so it's good exercise, very good exercise, and a very good social club as well.
Yeah.
So I have done my stint as captain in my day there. And as I sit here and look out the window, I look directly onto the golf course. So it's still very much a part of our lives, but I'm afraid I've given up the golf. Or it's given me up.
Yeah, well, I think it's but same with me. Well, my first days of golfing were at Stirling, but then I've moved up to Elgin and I played at Garmouth. I was a member of Garmouth, and that will come very much into when we're talking about St Andrews golf, because it was very definitely a links course, which was only playable at certain times according to the tide. So we'll come on to that, Liz, as we chat about St Andrews and golf.
Yeah, well, when you talk about St Andrews, it is very definitely considered to be the home of golf. And we've already done an episode, although I'd forgotten all about it, which was episode 55 of the first series, where we talk about the history of golf and golf in Scotland more generally. Whereas in this one, we're talking specifically about St Andrews. And St Andrews, more than any other place or town, is considered the home of golf.
Yes, and there's so many golf courses within the bounds of St Andrews or the area of St Andrews, that you can always get a game of golf at St Andrews, but not necessarily on the old course.
Yep, and it was here that on these links courses that you talked about, like Elgin and Garmouth, that golf started. Because if you think about it, before the days of the lawnmower, you couldn't play a parkland course because the grass was too long. So it was this strip known as the Macher, the area between the land and the sea, that was usually used in the old days as open common land. People would graze their cattle and sheep on it, but also it would be used for archery practice.
Yes, and I love when I'm doing my walking tours in St Andrews, telling the groups about James II, who decreed that the football and the gowf shall be utterly quiet down and not use it. I said, because he felt people were spending too much time, men in particular, spending too much time on the golf course and not enough time on their other chores. In his case, it was archery, but I think in 21st century, it might be other things around the house.
Well, in 1552, the Archbishop of St Andrews, a man called John Hamilton, he was able to get the use of this land for golf on permission that he was able to retain possession of the rabbits on the course. Because, of course, you know, if you go around the links today, you'll see all the burrows from the rabbits. So this was a very valuable source of meat. So he wasn't losing out on this. So he retained possession of the rabbits, but the people got the right to play golf on the links. And that was when the old course at St Andrews was officially established, right back to 1552.
Yes, and I love that story because when you tell that story out in a walking tour in St Andrews, people say, what, rabbits? But you're right, it was a very, very good source of meat. And of course, the fur, you know, for keeping warm, for making things, and the leather from it.
Yep. So all round the east coast of Scotland, when the ice began to melt after the last ice age and the land began to bounce back, you have this strip of land which is absolutely perfect. It's too barren for cultivation, but it's nice and soft, so that if you're using a wooden club, it didn't damage the wooden club. And it also had all these natural obstacles like holes, which would become the bunkers, and hazards that you had to get around. So that very much influenced modern golf course design.
Yes, because they realised that all these natural hazards just made the game very interesting and made it requiring a bit of skill, that you had to work it out.
Yep. And also being on the coast, harsh winds, gales, you had to have a lot of control. So it was perfect for challenging golfers. And through time, you began to get societies established, and none more important than the Society of St Andrews, which was formed in 1754.
Yes, and they from there on started playing a very important role in the overall game of golf, because from 1754 onwards, people were beginning to travel. It was becoming a little bit more open for everyone to play golf, because there was not much involved in the way of expense. But with travelling, they had to have rules. If they were going to have competitions, there had to be rules. So the rules of golf were beginning to be established at that point too.
Yeah, and you're talking about travel, but many of the members at this Society of St Andrews were also members at the Honourable Company of Gentlemen Golfers in Edinburgh. They would sail across the Firth of Forth, and so it was the first to print and publish the rules. But through time, the Society in St Andrews became more popular, and when they got a royal patron, William IV, he became the royal patron in 1834, and it then became the Royal and Ancient Golf Club of St Andrews. And through time, it really began to exert the greatest influence on the game. And it was here that the modern game of golf was established.
Yes, and it still is the great influence, because if I'm right, Liz, you can keep me right, that the Royal and Ancient set the rules for really the whole of the world except for America and Mexico, because they have their own PGA. But of course, the PGA and the R&A work absolutely hand in hand for the rules.
They do. I mean, the United States and Mexico have their own governing body, but over 30 million golfers in 124 countries around the world look to the Royal and Ancient Golf Club of St Andrews to set the rules and to manage many of the competitions that we have particularly the Open, the British Open, as others would know it, but to us simply the Open, and we'll come back to that later on. But if you go back to episode 55, the idea of having 18 holes, that was established at St Andrews, because originally it was 11 out and then 11 back through the same holes, but it was considered that the first two holes were too short, so they brought it down to 18. So now that's the standard. And also stroke play, because in the old days it was just matches that were played. Really, the game of golf was just a way of getting exercise to build up an appetite for the main event, which was eating and drinking. But then they actually began to think, well, that's not fair, because you're just drawn with a partner out of the hat. And I always used to feel that if anybody got me, they always think, oh no, what a dud I've got here. No. So they changed it, and instead of match play, the norm became stroke play, where it was the person that went round in the least number of holes. And today, most of our competitions are stroke play.
That's right. And of course, you know, one of the reasons, I know that the official reason for 18 holes is because the first four holes were combined to be two holes, reducing the original number down to 18. But in my view, Liz, that the reason it's 18 holes in a game of golf is that a bottle of whiskey has 18 drams in it. So if you take a dram after holing out at each hole, you have to stop at 18, at the 18th hole, because it only has 18 drams.
I think by that time, I don't think there'll be many people that would still be standing, never mind playing golf after
that. Or even counting.
And in the old days, of course, you know, all this this drinking on the course and all the rest of it. In the old days, it was very uncivilised, because right up until 2014, ladies were not allowed membership of the Royal and Ancient Golf Club. So they couldn't bring in their civilising influence. And it came to a head in 2014. Now, you may remember that there was something else happened on the 18th of September 2014, Helen. What else happened?
Oh, was that was that our independence? No?
It was. Yes. It was a referendum for independence. Yes. And there was another referendum, which in St Andrews was considered much more important, and that was whether or not they should allow women to be able to join, to be invited to join the Royal and Ancient Golf Club. And it was in the time when our Prime Minister was Gordon Brown, a fifer himself, and he threatened that if they didn't come into line with the equality and opportunity, then he would remove tax rebates. Well, that wasn't enough to drive them to it. You know, the men thought, oh, well, we'll just pay more money. We still want to escape from these women. But then it was said that in Alex Salmond's day in 2014, that if they didn't allow women equal opportunity, then they would not be able to hold any of the big competitions like the Open. Well, that was a threat too far. So they very rapidly held a referendum on the 18th of September, and it was agreed that women should be invited to join. Now, there had already been an embarrassment, because tradition has it that when the principal of the University of St Andrews is appointed, the Royal and Ancient invite them to play around and have dinner in the club. But at that time, we've had a succession of female principals, and there was an embarrassment. They couldn't invite her to play. Now, she got them off the hook, because she said that she didn't play golf, but she was still very much of a mind that this was an archaic rule and it should be changed. So when the ballot was held, then they invited her to join. She didn't accept it. But they also invited another royal, you know, to continue the tradition. And Princess Anne was one of the first females to be invited to join the Royal and Ancient Golf Club. And she did accept.
Oh, I didn't know that. That's very good. But it was a terrible time, because I had a friend whose husband was a member of the Royal and Ancient. And she was a golfer herself, but she had to kind of stand at the back door waiting for him to come out or you know, whatever. But the other one that I remember who was not a member, who was not really admitted, was I was doing a tour in St Andrews, and I thought, there's a small crowd gathering around the 18th green. And I wandered over, and who should it be holing out on the 18th but Bill Clinton, the ex-president of the United States. And he came off the course, and he literally went in the back door of the Royal and Ancient very quickly, obviously to the loo, because he was out within about, you know, 2 or 3 minutes and into his car and away down to Edinburgh where he was staying. But he wasn't allowed to use the main facilities. It was just in the back door. There you go. And out again.
Yeah. I mean, the Royal and Ancient Clubhouse stands right at the first and the 18th tee, and it's one of the symbols of golf. You know, it's over 150 years of history. It's been renovated and renewed, and in fact, at the moment, it's going through a major renovation.
Huge.
But you're right that only members who are invited to join the club can use the Royal and Ancient Clubhouse. And that gives rise to the building opposite it, which towers over it. And it's bright red sandstone, which is quite out of keeping with the old grey tune. But that's Hamilton Hall, and it's got quite a story.
Oh, I love the story of that. I can just see this man, American, of course, knocking on the door of the Royal and Ancient and asking if he can come in for a cup of tea. And they sort of say, "Are you a member?" And he says, "No." And they say, "Well, I'm sorry, you can't come in." And he goes away. "Phew, I'll sort you out," he says. "I'll build something bigger and better than the Royal and Ancient." And then he did that to the what is now the Hamilton Grand, Hamilton Hall. And so Thomas Hamilton just did that to eclipse the building of the Royal and Ancient. But has he done that, Liz, do you think?
No, I think he just increased the numbers of people that were coming to stay in the hotel and wanted to play golf at St Andrews. But he did introduce an important phrase into our everyday language, and that is blackballed, because still to this day, to be able to join the golf club, you have to be invited, you have to be nominated and seconded. And once you've been nominated and seconded officially, then the golf course holds, the golf club holds a ballot of its members. And traditionally, the way in which it's decided is if you want the individual to join and become a member, you put a white ball in the bag. If you don't think he's a good candidate for membership, then you put a black ball. And unfortunately, poor old Thomas Hamilton, when they held the ballot, got more black balls than white balls. So he was blackballed. He wasn't given membership. And so he established this this beautiful hotel, huge hotel, the first building in Scotland ever to have a pneumatic elevator. Just imagine lifts, imagine hot and cold water running in every room. It really was absolute splendour. And of course, the royals wanted to come and stay there. So the Prince of Wales, who would become King Edward VIII, he came and visited. And of course, once he came, everybody, Mary Astor, Douglas Fairbanks, Rudyard Kipling, Bing Crosby, you name it, they were all staying here. And of course, they all wanted to play golf. So in the end, he did the Royal and Ancient Golf Club a favour.
Yes, he did. And with that, that was where we got the beginning of the extension of different courses around St Andrews. Because by opening the floodgates to golfing tourism into St Andrews, the Royal and Ancient course, the old course, could not support it all. So we had the Duke's course, and then I think there's now up to 10 courses within easy reach of St Andrews.
Yeah, but 7 of those are, as you mentioned earlier, they're public courses that are under the protection of the St Andrews Links Trust. And that's there to protect the courses. It looks after public ownership, so that it looks after the course being sustainable. It also does so much good as well, because it provides free golf to the children of the town, because they have a junior golf programme. And also, you know, if you're a member of the old course, you're a member of the 7 courses as well. So you're a member of this public trust looking after the course.
Yes, and the residents of St Andrews are... They really get, if they can show that they are very definitely a resident and their voting rights come from their permanent residence in St Andrews, they get special membership of the Links Trust.
They do. So it serves its purpose as protecting and maintaining it, because you think of all the people that want to play it these days. And it also keeps the price within a reasonable, it's not one of these, you know, big corporate courses. It's there for the benefit of all. But no more so than the students who come to St Andrews. And after the hotel closed down, Hamilton Hall became a hall of residence. So in my memory, living memory, right up until relatively recently, it was one of the halls of residence. Just imagine that, having your hall of residence with the best view of the 18th green of St Andrews Old Course.
Yeah, for 56 years, it was a student residence. And of course, nowadays, again, people are quite surprised that this very beautiful grand building was a student residence. But I don't think they would have the hot and cold water in all the rooms, Liz. I think they'd still be queuing up in the corridors for some of the bathrooms that were available for students in the time of the mid-20th century.
Yeah, I think so. I think there must have been a good number of parties that went on when there was an Open being played in the town, or a big competition. But if you go there nowadays, no longer halls of residence, you know, business, you know, there was more money that could be made out of it. And Hamilton Hall was bought over by the Kohler Company, Herb Kohler, probably best known for his white chinaware, the bathroom ware in the United States. He was a great aficionado of the game of golf. He died last year, unfortunately. But he started to buy up many world-class golf destinations and turn them into high-class golf destinations. And one of these was the Hamilton Hall, which he's converted into a number of very luxurious apartments.
Yes, they're quite spectacular. I haven't managed to get into any of the apartments yet, but I have been as far as the reception area, you know, the downstairs lobby. I was picking up some guests there, and I decided, because I'd travelled over from here to St Andrews, and you know, before you go out on your walk, you want to go to the loo. So I said to the concierge, "I'm just going to pop down to the loo." He said, "Oh no, I'll have to escort you." So he had to take me through all the locked doors from the main lobby to the public loo, which was very nice, Liz, I have to say.
Right, so yeah, because he also, as well as buying up Hamilton Hall and converting it to posh residences, he also bought up the Old Course Hotel at St Andrews, which stands on the site of the old railway station. And Mr Kohler, following his love and his passion for St Andrews, he renovated the hotel and made it a fantastic destination now. But also, many of our listeners will know it because if you've ever watched the Open on television, you'll know that there's a famous hole, the 17th hole, where as they're coming towards the end of the round, golfers have to make the decision, are they going to play safe and play a dogleg, or are they going to take a chance and are they going to fire right across the old course, the ground of the Old Course Hotel, and cut off the dogleg. So it's many a golfer has come to their sticky end on the 17th hole.
Yes, and I remember, Liz, when the old course was, you know, first up, was first built, and the first Open that was played on the old course at that time. And there was great discussion in the commentary about what the golfers were going to do and what would be the wisest things. And of course, the golfer, the actual professional golfer, can only take advice on the course from his caddy. So the caddies were very much involved in making these big decisions as well.
Yeah, I'm afraid, in the words of Sir Alec Ferguson, that's squeaky bum time. I wouldn't like to be in that position. But there's so many icons in and around the first and the 18th holes at St Andrews. And, you know, if any of our listeners have ever visited St Andrews, you'll know that there is a track that runs right across the first and the 18th holes. It's called Granny Clark's Wynd, and the public can cross on this because these are public golf courses. They belong to the residents of St Andrew. And you can even drive vehicles. So some of our drivers, when we're out on tour, will actually take the coach across Granny Clark's Wynd.
Yes, and it's you know, people are just amazed that we're driving over the famous road hole, and it's great. But I must say, when I'm walking over it, Liz, across that road, I kind of be looking for the left and to the right all the time. But normally at the height of the season, they have a steward standing on either end of the road, and they will tell you when it's safe to go over.
Yeah, and if they don't have one, these rangers that look after the course, then you can be sure that the caddies who are standing on the tee will absolutely holler at you to get out of the way. Who was this Granny Clark? Well, it said that the Clarks had a little cottage, and in the old days, the locals would sometimes use the area as a communal drying green. And so the Clark family, around about the early 1800s, supervised people who were drying their clothes on this communal drying green, and they'd provide endless cups of tea and sandwiches, very popular. So the Wynd was named after them. So if anybody wonders who Granny Clark was, she was giving tea and sandwiches to the people drying their clothes on the communal drying green.
Well, there's learned something today, Liz. That's great.
Yeah, so lots of icons. We've got Granny Clark's Wynd, the Swilken Bridge. Helen, have you had your photo taken on the Swilken Bridge?
Absolutely, yes. I love the Swilken Bridge. But I didn't realise that the Swilken Bridge is actually, we're only seeing a little bit of it, because it would appear that old Tom Morris, who we've still got to talk about, but old Tom Morris, he sort of redid the work that had been done in the 1830s to kind of really try to culvert the burn that ran all across the golf course to bring it into a kind of a simple path. And they built a bank then, and they filled in the burn, built a bank, and just directed the burn in the direction it is today. But old Tom further built up the walls, and the thought is that the bridge that we see today is only about, you know, half of it.
Mm-hmm.
And there is a discussion as to whether or not it was a pack horse bridge, which is the one with no sides so that the load on the pack horse could get by. But I think the decision is that it's not a pack horse bridge. It was always built as a golfer's bridge.
Yeah, because we've got to remember that we're building on sand here, which is moving continuously, you know, with it being this macker, these sand dunes. So even the old course hotel that we've been talking about, when they built it, they had to put it on underground floats to counterbalance all this movement on the sand. So it's not surprising that building the Swilken Bridge, they had to take this into consideration. But nowadays, anybody that has any interest in golf knows this iconic bridge that goes over the Swilken Burn, because the top golfers, no matter what the era, the top golfers always love the old course at St Andrews because it really tests their skills to the ultimate. And so this bridge has become iconic in terms of them getting their photo taken on their last round around the old course in St Andrews. So think of people like Tom Watson, Arnold Palmer, Nick Faldo. They've all had their photos taken here, but probably the ones that stick in recent memory, certainly Tiger Woods, but the best of all, who was that, Helen?
I think we're talking about Jack Nicklaus when he held up the claret jug.
Absolutely. But also Seve Ballesteros.
Oh,
because
yes.
Remember, he came on to win the Open, the fist pump that became his symbol.
Yes.
That was the symbol of his company. And really, the people of St Andrews took Seve Ballesteros to the heart.
Yes, and just before the 150th Open, that was just a couple of years ago now, they did a wonderful, wonderful piece of sand art on the West Sands of Seve. And it was beautiful to see that. You know, it was just absolutely lovely.
Yeah, very special place in the heart. You know, it's the family of golf. St Andrews very much involved in that. And of course, St Andrews very much associated with golfing families. What families do you think of when you think of golf in St Andrews?
Well, I must say that I grew up and my mother talking about the Auchterlonies, you know, Auchterlonie golf clubs, Auchterlonie this, Auchterlonie that. So that was one of the big families. And of course, the Morrises, Tom, old Tom and young Tommy.
Yeah, well, I was fortunate enough this year on one of my tours, I had a descendant of the Auchterlonies, because the Auchterlonie family, originally five brothers, all great golfers, but two absolutely outstanding. So Lawrence, or Larry, who was born in St Andrews in 1868, he went across to the United States and he became the professional at Glenview. And he won the US Open Championship in 1902, but he won it using a new ball called the Haskell ball. And so he returned to St Andrews and he won the Scottish professional golf competition in 1919. But he began to take on the family tradition of producing clubs and balls. And the second brother that was really good was Willie, who was born in 1872. And he also went on to win the Open. And he made the clubs that he used to win the Open himself. In those days, there was only seven clubs in the bag. So they became a very, very famous golf club producing company. And Auchterlonie's still there
St
Andrews.
Yes.
And they've been pros several times, the Auchterlonie family. So great golfers, but particularly known for their club making.
Yeah, I'm just having a wee smell to myself because when the Willie Auchterlonie saying seven clubs in the bag, that was my father's mantra. He was five. My father always carried just seven clubs in a little pencil bag over his back. One wood, one putter, a wedge, a three and a five. And that was all he carried in his bag. So he must have been thinking of the Auchterlonies when he did that. Right up until into his 80s, that's all he did with his golf.
Well, I must confess that in my day, I could have travelled round with two clubs in my bag, a seven iron and a putter.
Yes.
I remember on one occasion, we were actually in Thailand and we got invited to play at the Royal Bangkok. My husband played at Royal Bangkok, but we, as a family, my daughter, myself, and I, and Brian, played in Royal Hua Hin, which was the summer residence of the king. And you had to have a caddy, and the caddies were ladies. And when you went into the rough, it was jungle. I was playing, and my caddy very quickly realised that the only club that I could play was a 7-iron. And she just kept on handing me 7-iron, 7-iron, 7-iron. And every time that the ball went off into the jungle, they would go in and say, no, just leave it, just leave it. No, she would go in and she'd come back up and hold this ball up triumphantly. But I tell you what, the wee woman who got my husband, she had this permanent grin on her face all the way around. She really had got the luck on that day. Those that got my daughter and myself, not so lucky.
Yeah, because Brian's a very good golfer, isn't he?
Yes.
Yeah. But I think talking about golfers in St Andrews, old Tom and Tommy Morris, his son, they are just really the names to conjure with. And they have a very sort of sad story as well, young Tommy. And that can be seen on a wonderful film that came out relatively recently called Tommy's Honour. And I know that it's available in the United States because some of my people have seen it. It was on television here, just talking about the changes. And one of the things that really struck me about that film is the difference between professional golfers then, you know, the end of the 18 into the early 1900s, and professional golfers now. The only money that professional golfers then were making were really what they got as the result of wagers by their sponsors. They didn't get, there was no prize money as such, except if they won the game, they got the money.
Yeah, so they had to take on other jobs as well as the golf. You know, in those days, they were groundsmen, and eventually through time, they became golf course designers, but they really couldn't make a living out of it. So you talked there about young Tom Morris. His father, old Tom Morris, was really at the vanguard of these professional golfers. The first one was a man called Alan Robertson in St Andrews, and he was also a golf club maker. He also made golf balls, but he was really considered to be the first, and he was the mentor of old Tom Morris. And in fact, he took on old Tom Morris as an apprentice in his company, making the feather balls, the featheries, which were sort of little leather pouches with boiled goose feathers stuffed inside them. But horror of horrors, old Tom Morris used one of the newfangled gutta-percha balls in a competition. And so that was a big fallout between Alan Roberts and old Tom Morris as he began to change to the new ways. But it's probably young Tom Morris that sticks in the public imagination because he was possibly the greatest golfer of all time. And he was, you know, so highly regarded amongst others. He won the Open competition, the British Open, just 17 years of age, and he won it by a margin of 11 strokes.
That's amazing.
He went on to win it three times, so that they awarded him the red Morocco leather belt that was the trophy for the Open.
Yes, and the Alan Robertson that you were mentioning there, his gravestone in St Andrews graveyard is fascinating. I always point it out, and I think for anybody who's got a golfing sort of somebody golfing in the family and who are thinking of a headstone, Alan Robertson's headstone has got crossed golf sticks on it with a golf ball underneath. So I think that's a lovely sort of sculpture to have on his gravestone, the golf clubs and ball.
Yeah, I think that's a pilgrimage which golfers in St Andrews go on to walk around the cemetery down at the cathedral. And of course, one of the famous graves is young Tom Morris himself. And if you go and have a look at it, you'll see that he died at a very early age. He was playing across in North Berwick. And I said that a lot of the golfers, you know, were members at the club in the Honourable Club of Gentlemen Golfers in Edinburgh, which was based at North Berwick, but also at St Andrews. And he was playing in a challenge match across there. And there was a telegram which was delivered to the clubhouse, which said that his wife was dangerously ill. She was about to give birth and she'd gone into labour and they were really concerned about her. But the provost in North Berwick decided that he wouldn't hand the telegram over in case it affected the match. And so when the match was over, they gave him this news and somebody put their yacht at his disposal to get him across, to get him home so that he didn't have to go home on the rail journey. But as he walked up from the harbour towards his home, there was a second telegram which said that his wife had died. And so he never recovered from the shock of the loss of his wife and his children. I think they were twins that his wife was having. And when he went to his bed on Christmas Eve, he died in his sleep and he was just 24 years of age. So a really tragic story. And that's why when you look at his gravestone, you'll see that he died so young.
Yes. And also, again, this film, Tommy's Honour, that is depicted so well. And it just shows that it was a matter of months from the death of his wife to his own death. He just went right downhill, died of a broken heart.
Yeah. Sad story.
Yeah.
But mentioned there that his father, old Tom Robertson, had upset his employer. He didn't use these little featheries, the little goose balls that were made by the cordoners, the shoemakers in the town, and instead he used a gutta percha ball. And there's an interesting story behind that, because the minister in the town of St Andrews in the mid-19th century got a package from his brother, who was a missionary in India. He was the Reverend James Patterson. And he sent home a black marble idol as a donation to the museum of the university. And when his brother was unpacking it, he found that to protect it, it was wrapped up in strips of gutta percha, which is a kind of rubbery material. And his brother was sort of feeling this and thought, that would be really good to make a golf ball out of that, you know, to pad it out with this. So that's when, you know, how you've taken the plastic covering off, and we've all done it in our time, we've all stripped the rubber right down to the core. Well, that's gutta percha. And that was the start of these new balls, which were much more durable, much more hard wearing, and they were cheaper. So that really opened up the game to the masses again, instead of these expensive clubs and golf balls that were the elite were the only ones that could afford them.
Yes, and they were able to be mass produced rather than handmade, as the featheries had to be done. So that was a really big major breakthrough. And of course, you mentioned the cordoners who had been doing the original leather balls, and it was really the tradesmen who'd made the equipment for golf, because it was the joiners who did the clubs, and it was the blacksmiths who then did the metal, the iron heads for them. It was an extension of their trades, really.
Yep, and then they became, you know, craftsmen in their own right, making golf clubs, and still to this day, the home for many. Although United States now, for mass production, leads the way. So all the new equipment that comes out these days, largely coming from the United States, but still golf club manufacturers in St Andrews, but no longer the hickory wooden shaft, no longer the wooden clubs, because, you know, they recognised that even although they were playing on the sandy links, they still had tracks that got all rutted with carts going over them. And so they needed something stronger, you think, after they were breaking so many clubs. And so that's when we started to get into the idea of putting iron heads onto these hickory shafts. And that took root, and we now got all the different clubs that we have today.
Yeah, and if you still want to play a round of golf with a hickory shafted club, you can still do that within very close proximity to St Andrews. There is a small club there that is their USP. You play with your hickory shafted clubs just outside St Andrews.
Yeah, and you can get dressed up in all the old fashioned clothes as well to play your round. But I think nowadays most people are interested in, can I play the old course? Can I get in on the action and play this most iconic of all courses in the world? And the answer to that is yes.
Yes, you can, but it's not as easy as just, you know, turning up and saying, when's my turn? You have to actually, there's quite a protocol, a procedure to go through. You've got to put your name into a ballot, and if you're lucky, you're given a tea time. If you're unlucky, you can turn up at dawn and just wait until the starter says, well, there's three going out, you can join them as a fourth, or whatever. Or you can just arrange your golf holiday with one of the sort of operators that specialise in golf tours, like Lynx Golf and others within St Andrews. And they will get a better chance of getting a tea time.
Yep. So, you know, just like golf across Scotland, it's golf for all. You can either throw money at it and go to one of the big boys and get your game assured, or you can do the ballot 48 hours before and you'll know on that day, 2 days before, if you've got a slot or not. Or, as you say, Helen, there's quite a good chance of you just being able to walk up, because the locals who are members of the golf course, if it's a cold and wet day, they might not be inclined to go out. So there's always spaces coming up, and some people will camp overnight. I don't know if you'd be in a very good condition to play golf, but you can camp out overnight to be there at the head of the queue as they begin to allocate these places. And it used to be in the old days that you needed to have a certain handicap before you could play. Nowadays, as long as you've got a registered handicap, and it has to be a registered official handicap, either the paper or the digital copy. In the old days, a letter of recommendation would do, but not anymore. You have to have that official handicap and you can go out and play.
Yeah, and I did have a group of four that I was taking round on tour, and they wanted to play the old course. And I just phoned them up and said, is there a chance of a spot? And there was that day. So they got out. They were just, in seventh heaven to have played the old course. It was towards the end of the day, so they had just enough time to do the 18 holes before the darkness came down. But they did it.
And if you're a golfer, it's difficult to imagine just how sacred that experience would be. I had a lady, I think she may have been a Scottish Blethers listener, who contacted me last year. And her nephew was just about to graduate from college in the States, and he was a golfer. And what she wanted to give him as a graduation present was a round at St Andrews. And I'm very fortunate. So my husband's a good golfer. He has many friends, and one of them is a member of the old course. He lives in St Andrews. And so I was able to arrange that my husband Brian and his friend Craig took this young lad out. Now, because they did that, they didn't need to have a caddy. It's not essential to have a caddy. A caddy is generally there to give you information about the yardage and which shots to play and replace your divots and make sure that you keep up with the speed of play. But because he was a member, they didn't need a caddy. And so they went out and he had a fabulous time.
Oh,
but
yes.
The biggest challenge was that he had feet which were a size 13. So it's basically throw away the shoes and use the box. Yeah. So the challenge was to find him a pair of shoes, and we actually came up with one. Billy Archibald at Salon Golf Club has big feet like he did, so he was able to lend him a pair of golf shoes.
Oh my goodness me. Yes, because, and of course, I thought you were going to say the biggest challenge was getting Brian to stop talking when he was playing.
No, that's impossible. You know, miracles take a little longer.
So, well, Liz, I think we've done our bit for golf at St Andrews, so we should maybe be looking at words now, should we?
Well, I think you've got the first one here, Helen.
Well, I'm going to just go for the straight old-fashioned word of gawf, G-A-W-F, gawf, which actually means not golf, it means to hit or to strike or to cuff something. So, or it could also come from the Dutch word golf, which is K-O-L-F, which is a bat. And we have great influence from the Netherlands in the east side of Scotland, the East Nuke. So that could be quite a real derivation of the word, the K-O-L-F, or gawf, which is what James II told him to stop playing, gawf.
Yeah. Good Scottish word. And I get fascinated by the good old-fashioned names for the golf clubs. Niblick was a metal-headed club. And the one I love best is the Mashie Niblick, maybe because it's about the equivalent of a 7-iron. But this was your hickory shaft with a moderate loft on it.
Yes.
And so it had more slope on the head than a mid-mashie, but less slope than a mashie. So all these hickory golf clubs, my favourite, the Mashie Niblick. 7-iron.
Wonderful words for a great game.
It is, yep. And St Andrews, which has taken up two episodes now, the home of golf across the eyes of the world.
Yes. Well, Liz, thank you very much for another nice chat with you again.
Good. We'll need to think about what we're going to do next.
Oh, yes.
Okay. Bye for now.
Bye for now, everyone. Bye.
And there we have it, the end of another episode of Scottish Blethers. If you'd like to join us on social media, you can find us on Facebook and Instagram as at Scottish Blethers. And if you'd like to leave a review, please do so on your podcast platform of choice. It's cheery bye from me.
Ta-ta the moo from me. And if I don't see you through the week, I'll see you through the windy from me. Bye.
See ya.
Bye.